From local to global, we bring you the best conversations with your favorite athletes and Olympians.
This is the Olympics.com podcast.
Welcome to this Olympics.com podcast. Tom here, along with our entire podcast team, so focused on this extraordinary episode we're about to bring you. Imagine you're living two lives. The first, you're a child living in an unrelenting nightmare of indescribable pain, abuse, confusion, and deep isolation that takes you to places no one would ever want to go, with zero hope. Then part two, getting swept up in the long arms of care and love, rescued, really kind of life-flighted, out of a hellish reality, taken to the other side of the world, literally and figuratively, into an environment of saving grace, proper care, and tender guidance. That only barely approaches the journey of soon-to-be seven-time Paralympian, seven Paralympics in a row, and 17-time Paralympic medalist, Oksana Masters.
You're a 17-time Paralympic medalist and seven-time Paralympian, just hopefully is just very, very, I feel like I'm reading that about someone else I'm looking up to and want to do one day.
Long, long story short, Oksana is a living, breathing survivor of the horror that was the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown. Born in June 1989 in Ukraine with severe birth defects caused by radiation poisoning. Multiple congenital disabilities, like having six toes. Each hand had five webbed fingers, no thumbs, and legs that were different lengths with no weight-bearing shin bones, leading to a condition known as tibial hemimelia. Then it all got worse when her parents abandoned her, leaving Oksana to bounce around three different orphanages in Ukraine, brutally abused in each one, all before she turned seven.
It was definitely a unique way to start your first early years of life, knowing you're rejected, knowing you're not wanted, and being told, well, look at you, you're ugly. Of course, no one wants you.
Obviously, none of us can relate, but we all can maybe relate to a seismic comeback story of incredible proportions, and that is what we have here. Spirited up and away from her dark existence in 1987 by American college professor Gay Masters, she was unmarried and looking for a child to save and love. Suddenly whisked away from a hopeless life in Ukraine to the new world, the United States, Buffalo, New York. For Oksana, it was like the soul-saving end of a fairy tale, but only for a little while, because as she grew up, going to public school, Oksana was faced with the realities of a world judging her for abnormalities that she hardly even realized existed. She grew up this way. More pain and confusion. Now Oksana Masters moved with her mother to Louisville, Kentucky, and then came maybe the final devastation when doctors were forced to amputate her failing legs just above the knees. Somehow, against all odds, her character no doubt fortified by early years of suffering and challenge, Oksana literally reached out to adaptive rowing, and her life changed forever. Pushing oars and audibly grunting turned out to be a life-affirming therapy. The boat and water became her safe space from whence a warrior woman was evolving.
I have never felt more at home and finally that place where I belong than on that water.
Now Oksana is the most decorated United States Paralympian with 17 medals over five different Paralympics. In all, she's competed in six Paralympics, crossing over and back with three Winter Olympics and three Summer Olympics, earning a record 14 medals just 2 years ago at the Beijing Olympic Winter Games 2022.
Olympics.com podcast.
If all that is not accomplishment enough, Oksana shared the agony and ecstasy of her life story in her first book, The Hard Parts, a memoir of courage and triumph. So you can surely understand how honored we are to welcome Oksana Masters to this Olympics.com podcast. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time.
Thank you so much for letting me be here and share parts of my story.
So with Paris 2024 approaching, you soon to be a seven-time Olympian, 17-time Olympic medalist, and author. I bet you didn't see that coming when you were young.
No, especially, well, not of it, but definitely never an author. That just, especially since I was a child that wasn't really like into reading as well. But yeah, hearing 17-time Paralympic medalist and seven-time Paralympian, just hopefully is just very, very, I feel like I'm reading that about someone else I'm looking up to and want to do it one day.
Well, you've certainly earned all of that. I imagine writing the book was part, I mean, I read some excerpts. It's part devastating and yet, you know, obviously reliving the bad stuff, but a large dose of therapeutic relief and like a catharsis to when you're done.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, honestly, writing, I think what a lot of people don't realize when I was writing the book, and I had an incredible ghostwriter, Cassidy Randall, that I basically transcribed everything and sent over the way the process worked because I was training towards Tokyo. So I was doing my long 4-hour rides indoors and transcribing all the thoughts that were coming into my mind and had it recorded and then would send her the file for that. But it was definitely
while you were biking, you were dictating somewhat.
Yeah, while cycling.
Wow.
Yeah. So like for me, this is I love sports because for me, like writing the book was one form of therapy. But the way I got into sports was very much related to my therapy for my mind and emotionally and mentally. Every time I would just go, and especially in endurance sports that I really do, you can just get in a zone and zone out. And I actually do go back to some of those memories because it's where I'm processing. It's kind of, I'm not actively in that moment of that thought because I'm distracted by the motion of my training, but my mind is going through that and releasing these memories. And what I was saying earlier is what I think a lot of people don't realize when I wrote the book, there was a lot of things that I was verbalizing for the first time onto from like my memories to words on paper. And that itself was very therapeutic. And also, like you said, it was really challenging because I believe that there's so much power in the word. And I was so afraid to verbalize the things I experienced because then it made it real. It's very different having these dreams, waking up with a sweaty bed and being triggered by sounds and scents, but it's another thing for you to say the words and for you to hear these words and that you can't escape from. In that sense, getting it, releasing it, that was step one. Well, I guess the middle of my stepping stones of the therapy of releasing and writing the book and in hopes of, even if it's just one person or that it helps. Whether, you know, you don't have to be an orphan to experience these things. Unfortunately, things happen in very healthy home environments that people don't know. And, or the big thing is that it helps shine a light on orphanages and what really happens in the orphanage systems and foster care systems and something so much greater than just what I lived through and experienced.
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't mind, take us back to the early memories, trying to figure out who you were. Like, where's my mom and dad? What's going on here? Those recurring questions that a lot of us don't have to deal with.
Yeah. And I had, you know, being adopted when I was almost 8 years old, I was very well aware that I had no family. My last orphanage is where I have most of the memories from. That one was a unique one because it was like a boarding school and a part of it was an orphanage where there were the kids with, at that time, I had no idea because I didn't know I was different.
Right.
It was for kids with special needs and disabilities, so cognitively and physically, that didn't have family. And I saw 300 kids at the boarding school always going home for holidays and their parents could come and see them. I never had that. And I saw that all the time. I remember so many times where there would be family, like people were interested in adopting, and it was a show and tell. They put on a dress on you, a bow on you.
Oh.
That's the first time that I looked forward to those days. I started resenting those days, but I looked forward to it because that was the only time we ate and we had something that wasn't just liquid in our soup. And it was really challenging because I didn't know why I didn't have a family. And you know, the weirdest thing is I always dreamed of a mom. I never really necessarily dreamed and wished for a mom and a dad. My biggest goal was, where's my mom? I thought every woman that was coming was my mom. And I dreamed for just a mom and a home. And that's exactly what I got. But it was definitely It was definitely a unique way to start your first early years of life, knowing you're rejected, knowing you're not wanted, and being told, well, look at you, you're ugly. Of course, no one wants you, and that you're, I'm a bad girl. I pushed every button there was to push because I thought even painful attention was better than no attention at all.
I get that. And you referenced the things you were dealing with, and in your book you talk about, to you, these anomalies weren't birth defects, they were just you. Like, it, you didn't quite put that together, right? For a little while.
Yeah, like I was aware that I didn't walk like some of the people there, and my body was in pain all the time, but I thought everyone experienced that and felt that, and that was just normal. And I think that was the hardest thing, is my version of what was normal, and my body's normal, and my way of, it was the hardest transition coming from Ukraine to America, was the safeness, the warmness, and the comfortability, like the comfortable beds. I had such a hard time adjusting to it because it was not normal for me. And I had no idea that my body was different at all. I was getting piggyback rides all the time from the other kids. And it was, instead of me focusing on, oh, wow, I'm so deformed, I'm disabled, I can't do this, I can't do that, my thoughts specifically were, I want to get out of here, I want a family, I want a home. And that was my only view, and my identity I had of myself was, no one loves me, no one wants me, what did I do wrong?
Also in your book, you describe your experience in orphanages, that you alluded to some of this, cold, dark, cruel, and in your bed at night. You know, where a lot of us feel like at night we go to bed, that's where we maybe feel the safest. We can cuddle up and all that. But for you, it wasn't like that.
No, it was not. Honestly, to this day, I struggle with sleep. It's very, very challenging, because what ended up and what was the hardest part for me to share through the book and accepting and realizing that this is what it was, because going back, I thought this was all normal. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. Until I lost my really good friend in the orphanage, I didn't realize how much, like, I experienced these things, but I didn't know how much she was protecting me from until she was gone. And it was ran as a brothel, and in that specific wing specifically. And I really don't know why, besides I was the smallest girl. So I don't know I really don't know why the last few years I was there, it was really, really bad on me specifically. The girls, I mean, they were boys too, but a lot of the girls were not up there. I was up there by myself. And there was no windows in there. It was dark. So the only thing you could see was the shadow of footsteps from the hallway outside. And I, even in the book I share, I asked my mom, she saw the steps to go up into that door and was wondering what's up there when she was touring the orphanage. And they very quickly shut that down. And she felt a pit in the stomach, one of those gut feelings, nothing good up in there. It took me literally all of 30 plus years to admit to myself what happened and process that I didn't deserve it, that it wasn't right. Normal what was happening, but it was so hard to not believe it when it's all you know. And, you know, I shared that in the book to highlight what happens in orphanages, what happens in Eastern European orphanage when orphans do not have, you know, the financial support, the financial needs. A lot of the U.S. Paralympic athletes, not that they went through that, a lot of them were adopted when they were younger, and there's a few that were adopted older. But, you know, a lot of Paralympic athletes in the U.S. are adoptees from multiple different countries. And they're one of the most really dominating athletes in the U.S. Paralympics as well. And I think it's partially, like, whether you're adopted as a baby or as almost 8-year-old or a 14-year-old, we know how to fight and survive and to never give up. And that, I wanted to share this part because U.S. Paralympics has a connection to a lot of these athletes who are adoptees. The Paralympic movement in general as a whole, and honestly, Olympic athletes also come from adoptive stories or come from foster care and experience something. And I always questioned, why was I the one that made it out and none of my friends that I know of? And I felt so guilty for surviving. this experience I talk about in the book when I lost my really good friend. And it was, I think, that survival remorse of guilt too. And I think my why to that question, or the answer to that question, was to, so I can shine that light on what happens to make a better future for these kids who do not have access to families and whose families want to give them a home and safety, medical needs, but financially cannot.
Right.
Because that's, I think, what happened with my birth family is just as a child, you are unaware of any of that.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, for many years now, we're fortunately welcomed into this new world of understanding mental health and the approach. And if you feel something, say something. But it seems like you're ahead of the curve. I mean, you've had to process all of this. So this must be like a feeling of, yeah, finally, you know, you're feeling it around you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy that this conversation and mental health and therapy for not just like your, especially for athletes,
exactly,
that they're safe enough to talk about the therapy that they're going through and that's helping them for their mind, especially because, yes, we go through a lot of things, physical therapy, prehab, rehab stuff, our bodies, for everything we put ourselves through. But, you know, the fact that it's becoming more normal and it's something that is, should have always been talked about instead of swept under the rug, it does make me feel like I'm not alone. And thank God, like, I'm not that weirdo that I was the only one that had to go through this and had to talk to someone to help me. Because in middle school and high school, it was something you never share you're going through.
Right.
And it's challenging to go through, you know, get mental health support and then also keep it under the rug. So it's like, well, is it really helping you when you're doing it in secrecy and you can't say anything and outside you're trying to cover everything up? But then when you're there and you're working on everything to help you be the best person you can be, it was challenging and confusing. So I'm happy that this is something that's being talked about and it is a good relief. And the fact that it's for everyone, I think what people are very much surprised by, wow, all these athletes at the highest level, Olympic, Paralympic athletes, you have so many like Simone Biles, Michael Phelps, all these incredible athletes that are talking about mental health and the importance of it. I think they were shocked to know, oh my gosh, this athlete on top of this world has everything. They're good at everything. They're needing this too. And I think hopefully that shows we're all human at the end of the day. We all need to take care of our minds just as much as we've taken care of our bodies, right, as well. And that it's not bad at all.
Well, you know, kids look up, you guys are all role models. And when elite athletes open the door to this whole other world of figuring out why you're feeling a certain way and that you don't have to, as you mentioned, I mean, it's really benefited everybody. It's long overdue and we got a long way to go still. But so talk about divine intervention. Welcome, Gay Masters. What do you remember of meeting the person who you now call mom?
Oh my gosh. I have this cheesy smile on my face because that's like literally, it was, I don't know how to explain it, where someone who wasn't in my shoes, but it's like something that you dream of your whole entire life. And then all of a sudden it is real and it is right in front of you. And you can not only just look at it, but you can grab it and hold it and you know it's going to be yours forever. Mm-hmm. And that was with my mom. You know, our journey to find each other, unfortunately, took 2 years and she didn't know that I knew of her.
Wow.
But when she chose me and I looked at her picture every single day, and I think, okay, this is going to sound so weird because I looked at her picture every single day that says I'm basing this, my home and the safetyness, everything. And it was, I don't know if you've ever seen those commercials, the M&M commercials, where like Santa is going through and he's putting presents out and the commercial of the little M&Ms, and they're like, oh, he does exist. And he looks back, yep, and he's like, they do exist, the M&Ms. And yep, that's kind of what it was for me. Like, she's real. She does exist. This is not just a dream that I have dreamt. And she, I'll never forget that night when she came. It was in the middle of the night. I threw my big hissy fit because they promised me she was going to be there in the afternoon to get me. And at that point, it was getting delayed, and I questioned, why is she not coming? What's happening? Mm. And there was a lot of, you know, using that against me of when I was bad, they would use that against me. Well, she's seeing what you're doing and they don't want a girl like you because you're not a good girl. And after 2 years, in a year and 3 months, you start to realize, oh my gosh, she can see what I'm doing. I need to stop. Right. Little did I know what I was doing was survival. It wasn't me being bad. So that night, I did not want to go to sleep because I thought if I go to sleep, it was going to be over. That dream was going to be over. She was never going to come. And then in the middle of the night, we're down in this room where there's 7 orphans, myself included, are in there. And I hear these like noises. And then I look up and there's an interpreter there, the director of the orphanage, my Aunt Sherry, who went with my mom and was a huge part of that adoption story as well. And my mom and the adoption person that was there to help as well. And the director of the orphanage says, Oksana, do you know who this is? In Ukrainian. And I look at her and I was so stupid and cheesy. I'm like, God, all the things. I'm like, I know you. You're my mom. I have your picture. And I go to grab the picture as if this picture solidifies. You're going nowhere. This is you. You're mine. Kind of thing. And they let me have her picture because I was throwing a hissy fit. And they're like, okay, well, we'll let you bring this picture with you next to your bed. I promise she's going to call. That was probably the nicest they ever were in that orphanage was that night. And, you know, honestly, for as bad as the director of the orphanage, he was, he did have some goodness in his heart because he was having a lot of heart health conditions and he did not want to go to the hospital to help himself until he made sure I made it out of there.
Wow.
And that was, I guess, it's, you know, so ironic and so weird for how they can mistreat you to the point you're basically on the verge of dying and you're not expected much life expectancy because of what they did to you. To that kindness, it was very confusing to learn.
Yep.
But yeah, my life changed forever in that middle of the night.
Wow. Well, you know, your whole story is profound and inspiring, and that's a gift you have now to spread. But then comes the part where you're coming to America. It's like that movie. I mean, it's everybody's in, you know, some fairy tale dreams. You're coming to the U.S. and it's a saving grace, but it also presented new and, you know, as I read the parts of the book, unforeseen challenges and more pain. I mean, it wasn't the end of the story. It was the continuation of having to adjust to a lot.
Yes. I mean, that's really where my life, I feel like, really began and where I really started living. And that was the start of, you know, there's that physical pain I felt. But what was really challenging and in some ways almost harder was the mental side and the processing. And, you know, I had my mom and I was like that movie Annie where she gets to walk home and Daddy Warbucks is walking her through her home and there's chandeliers and there's the warm lights. And I felt like that when I got to America, especially like that when it was the middle of the night, we were hungry and my mom took me to Walmart and oh my gosh. First of all, I've never seen light so bright in my life. I've also never seen food that was so colorful and that wasn't locked up in any way. And it was just right there. And I was touching and feeling everything. And it was literally a dream. And the challenges that, you know, I had coming to America were, so I didn't speak any English. My mom didn't speak Ukrainian. I went to school when as I started learning English was, and the first time I was learning words and forming my new home, it was kind of, this is, I think, where the downfall of everything for me starts. It was obviously, I was so happy to be here at home, but
sure,
this is where the starting point of me seeing myself as less than and disabled and being not capable of anything, because I was learning words in English for the first time. Around that time, people were telling me I'm different and it's bad and what's wrong with you? You're ugly. What's wrong with your hands? And so the first words I'm learning in language are negative words. So it's kind of, it was kind of very challenging because my first life experiences were pain, physical pain. I wasn't allowed to show any emotions. I wasn't allowed to talk or anything, show anything. And then now when I come to America, everything is so great health-wise and I have a home, but that was something I did not understand. And then I had to learn, well, what is disabled. It says, I can't do this and I can't do that. And that being different is horrible. It's the worst thing you can be in this world, which never made sense to me because in fashion, oh my gosh, everyone's trying to stand out and be all different. But God forbid our bodies
right.
are different in any way.
So like bullying, it was a whole nother thing. It was new to you. And that was sort of the language you were learning. And then you realize once you learned, it was probably incredibly painful. And then you got to process that for several years, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was for all the years because I was still learning English and I didn't have anyone to go back to. There were so many times I would say, I go back Ukraine. I hate America as a child. Because I didn't know how to deal with bullying and why and where it's coming from. And it lasted a while. And, you know, I was the only child in all of my schools up until high school where I was that different mm-hmm. kid. They made fun of me for having an accent and for talking weird, which now I regret because I told my mom, like, I don't want to sound Ukrainian. I want to sound American. Everyone says I talk weird. I sound weird. Now I'm like, gosh, I wish I had a cool accent because I got rid of that and worked so hard to get rid of it and to blend in. And then just not even knowing, because I honestly didn't comprehend what was wrong with my legs. I didn't understand like what the difference was until I started getting my legs amputated. And then my legs were prosthetics. They weren't real legs. And on top of that, my first amputation was when I was 9 and the second one when I was 14. And honestly, my second amputation was where I really took a deep dive and really started hating myself, hated what I saw in the mirror. I really let others, people's perceptions of how they viewed me really dictate of what I thought about myself and what I thought was possible. And on top of that, my first leg was above the knee amputee. My second leg amputation, I told them, they said, you have to make the choice of when you're ready to amputate. We can no longer save this leg. And they said, okay, a few months go by and the pain is so unbearable. I'm ready to amputate this leg under one condition. Can you amputate below the knee? Right. I need to save my knee because if you have a knee, honestly, I feel like every Paralympian is going to kill me when I say this. But this is a joke when it comes into like the Paralympic mm-hmm. community. And I think a lot of people it'd be fun for them to know that the sense of humor is there. But as an above the amputee, we all look at below knee amputees as paper cuts. It's really not that big of a deal because you can still run. And then if you have two, it's like an annoying paper cut in your hair. It's just annoying, but you can still do so much. The minute you're missing both of your knees and feet, you are limited. You can do it in different ways, but there's just some things I will never be able to do a squat, mm-hmm. period. And it's just without support or anything like that, and run normal or all these other things. And then right after I'm on Happy Juice before the amputation, they look at my x-rays one more time and they look at the videos and they decide it's going to be best for me in the long run to amputate above the knee. Wow. And apparently, when I was under sedation already and kind of not happy juice, I consented to it because at that hospital, I was considered an adult at 14. And I'll never forget the memory when I wake up from the surgery and I fall because I'm top heavy because I don't have the leverage from low part of my legs. And I see the amputations of both sides, both levels above the knee. On top of that, the epidural they put in shifted to the wrong side. So the wrong leg was amputated and I felt everything right out of surgery. Oh. And they were telling me that I have a weak pain tolerance. I have to let the medicine give it a chance until a couple of days later that my mom was like, she is completely paralyzed. She cannot move her left side, but right side, she's having all this like spasms and stuff. And they realized, oh, it was never numb.
Oh.
But I guess that's the blessing of the skies of what I experienced in Ukraine because that helped me get through that part. But that was just the start of me hating myself in a different way, being a 14-year-old girl, teenager, where it is the worst thing in the world if you have a zit or you're having a bad hair day. Imagine having two prosthetic legs now and walking into school and having hands, like my hands are also disabled. And it's just, I couldn't hide my differences, no matter what. And it was, that bullying started even more so because I started walking even more different and challenging. And I really started to kind of retreat to myself and just not really, I wasn't doing really healthy things to my body to process all of the things that were taken away from me and processing all these things until sport came into my life.
Right. That's where I am right now. Your mom apparently hounded you to try rowing. And in a way, she saved your life again, right?
Yeah, she saves my life. I guess like there's really three times I really say my life was saved in my lifetime. My mom saved my life literally from Ukraine because they told her I wasn't supposed to live past 10 years old. And then she saved it again by introducing the world of sports to me. And sport was that third thing that really saved my life because that's really where I started to learn the journey and on that path of loving myself, accepting myself, and seeing the strength my body still had despite of outside noises and society was telling me I didn't and what the mirror was telling me.
It's interesting because you said you didn't get into sports necessarily to win, but to help you understand yourself better. The winning is nice. It comes later, but that's quite an observation.
Yeah, I think and this is what's so hard because I listen to so many athletes like stories and journeys and read their books just to know what they come from. And a lot of them have that common theme of, I always knew I wanted to be Olympian. I knew I wanted to be Paralympian. And they knew they wanted to be athletes. And I had no idea I could be an athlete. I had no idea I could be a Paralympian because that was just not visible to me or ever talked about. Also, I'm missing my legs. How on earth can I be an athlete? But what I loved when I got into sports, and rowing was my first sport, it was my way where, the therapy as a child is very different when you're going through therapy as an adult and you're more in control of it and you're guiding everything instead of as a child, people are basing your experiences, what you're saying, dissecting what you're trying, and then medication is the only answer to make her normal. It was very challenging. So for me, and I, as a child, I wasn't verbalizing what I experienced because I thought, well, if I say this, my mom's going to hear this. She's not going to like me and she'll send me back to Ukraine. She's not going to want a dirty girl and a bad girl. And rowing, when I was on the boat, I didn't want to do it because it was adapted rowing. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to do something. So at that time, I'm 13. It's right before I get my second leg amputated. Is when I first try it. And at that time, I'm like, well, I'm not going to do a sport that's called adapted. It's another box. Why would I put myself in another box? And my mom was very persistent and just try. Nothing's going to happen. Try it once, never go back again. I have never felt more at home and finally that place where I belong than on that water. And back to your original statement about it being therapy was, it was a place where I didn't have to verbalize anything. I could internalize it, but let my body release everything. And in rowing, when I pulled against the oars, I felt that tension. It was my way of screaming. And then there's a release at the end of the stroke and you feel this light lift and you're light and you feel the boat again. And I love that. I love that sense of the power, just putting all my anger and frustration, confusion and lostness into that. And that's how I started processing everything. And to this day, like I was saying earlier on the bike, that's what I do. I go back to those moments. And, I think that was my step one to really healing and learning myself. I had to go back and fix those wounds and work on these wounds mentally, the things, the scars that people cannot see before, the visible scars and my legs, my accessories that people see very obviously. And it was therapy. And I learned to love it that way first versus winning and setting goals and trying to be the best in the world and trying to represent USA, because that was never, I never saw any of that. I never saw myself as that. I didn't know it was possible to do that, especially for me.
Well, you're not alone. For those of us who've had, the world is full of people who've had challenges when they were young, and sports has, saved me too. 17 Olympic medals and the most decorated Paralympian in USA history. So what has all of this taught you? I mean, I can imagine the lessons are many and very deep.
Gosh, it's so weird to hear people say that too. Honestly, I would say the lessons I think I'm learning through everything is the obvious don't give up, don't ever give up, but also never count yourself out. Because what a lot of people don't know about my sporting story and journey is, yes, they hear 7-time Paralympian, 17-time Paralympic medalist, most decorated Winter Paralympian in U.S. history. But what they don't see and hear are the failures. I learned how to lose first. That was as an athlete.
Right.
That was my first introduction. I didn't make the first Paralympic team I wanted to in 2008. I did not make the first 2 years of the national team in cross-country skiing. I did not get my gold medal in the Paralympic Games until my fourth Paralympic Games. And it happened right after I broke my elbow. And the journey is like, don't ever count yourself out, and to never put a timeline on your dreams, and to never compare your path and timeline to the person next to you, because it's going to be different. Like you said, sport plays a unique role in all of us, and it saves all of us and helps us in different ways. And we all have our unique journeys in that. Why compare that? My path I walk is very different from yours, from the person next to me. And that's so forth. The person next to me, my competitor, is going to have a very different journey. And it is hard to not compare yourself when you see that person trying sport for the first time and they succeed and win for the first time. And you're like, what? Because I went through it. Mm-hmm. But you're robbing yourself when you're doing that ultimately. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because when I reflect on everything now, my sporting journey and path literally paralleled and is parallel to my journey in life. Mm. I started out as an orphan. I wasn't guaranteed a mom right away. I didn't have a home. I had to learn how to fight for what I had and how to survive and work for everything. And I think when I wrote the book, that's something I learned was, oh my gosh, like my sports journey is the same as parallel to my personal journey. And I think when we just live in the moment and see each day and take the things that went well, focus on the things you want to improve, and do not limit yourself and never count yourself out, you can achieve what you're chasing, what you're dreaming, and what the goals you're setting for yourself. There's no timeline. There's no perfect timeline.
There's a lot there for sure. So you're an incredible athlete, 14 medals in winter sports, cross-country skiing, biathlon, 3 medals in summer Olympic, Paralympic sports, rowing, of course, cycling. Are there things like, how about wheelchair basketball? I'm a basketball player. I mean, what do you want to do? Nothing is limiting you.
Oh my gosh. Okay. First of all, if you ask my fiance, Aaron, who's also a Paralympic athlete and is going to Paris, he would tell you I'm the least athletic person in the world because the way he judges athleticism is by if you can dribble a ball or make a basketball. So I have no coordination. There's a reason why the sports I do is just put your head down and you go and you just suffer. I do love sports. I love, you know, life's too short to not try different sports. I actually have a set of running legs and I'm really excited. I have some pretty big and lofty goals set in running with those legs. And it's something that I've never felt that motion and that motion and movement in my body before. And I think that's what I really chase when I'm chasing a new sport is the way how my body feels and that different motion. But you can definitely believe I will never do anything with a ball. So no wheelchair basketball. I have hand-eye coordination with my body, but not when I dribble. The thought of swimming, I admire swimmers so much. But the idea of lactic acid burn and you being in the water terrifies me to death because it's just such a scary feeling. I would not want to feel like I'm dying and hold yourself up out of the water at the same time so you can breathe.
Yeah.
But I admire swimmers. And I also believe that there's some sports that are nice to do for fun and for yourself. You don't always have to take it to that competitive level. Right. And it's really nice to be bad at something too, because I love that. It's just, you're learning so much more. It keeps you very humble and gives you a different perspective on different sports and things that I don't get through the sports that I do.
So the Olympics and being Olympian means so much to so many around the world. But for you, does that mean more that, you know, you're at the top of your world in many, many ways?
No, I don't. You know, I think I wouldn't consider myself at the top at all. I think there's always room to grow, and you're at the top of one, but you could be at the bottom of the next little top, like mountain or that hill. And for me, like, it's not about being at the top. All it really means, and what I'm really like, what means more to me about being seen and recognized as being at the top, is that my voice will finally be heard. And that's something I never had as a little girl, is I didn't have a voice. And I think when you're at the top, your voice is heard more and it's seen more. And that's exactly what I wanted to. I want to share my voice and share my Paralympic sports, because the sports I compete in, honestly, are very underrepresented in Paralympics, but then in Olympics as well. You don't often see cross-country skiing, biathlon, rowing, and cycling as one of those highlighted sports. No. And when I think about the games coming to LA in 2028, home games, I want USA to fill every single female slot there is to fill across every single sport, not just track and field, not just swimming, not just gymnastics and basketball. And through that, I guess that's what excites me about being so fortunate and lucky to have the success I've been able to achieve so far, is my voice can hopefully help open that door and make it better for the next generation. And also in general, for Paralympic sport in the U.S., but globally and internationally, and there's something I'm really excited about. I'm going to start working through and work in the beginning stages of making cross-country skiing accessible to these countries, to these athletes in Thailand and Africa where they don't have snow. Wow. And they're kids. And that is what sport is so powerful. Every single human deserves the right to use their body and to access to sport, because there's so much you learn outside of winning. It's more about, you learn more when you set the goal and what happens when you don't achieve that goal, and learning that process of how to pick yourself back up. And just more fundamentally, everyone has the right, every human has the right and access to sport and to use their body and to play in general.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm really excited about in Paris, is hopefully my voice, whether I'm at the top of the podium, whether I'm on the podium, or if I'm not, I hope my voice will still carry through and help bring a light, and society doesn't see things as failures, but they just, you know, it's sport, we're human. We're going to have good days and bad days, but the bigger picture is making the Paralympic movement, growing it, and make sure it's better, and the sports and the Paralympic movement's better than it was when I got in, and it's better when I left for the next generation.
So you mentioned Paris. What are you most looking forward to at Paris 2024?
Oh my gosh, I love Paris so much. I love fashion so much. And it's like literally one of the capitals of fashion in the world. And I'm just really excited because, first of all, you know, I was saying how cycling's an underrepresented sport, Olympic-wise and Paralympic-wise. In France, it is such a huge sport. It is a way of life for them. And I honestly, it's one of those things I'm really excited about, is competing on my bike in a country that respects and knows bike racing, and just to feel the streets filled, and just in general, just being in Paris. It's so magical when you close, when the lights go down and the Eiffel Tower is sparkling. But I have this promise to myself I made that's motivating me so much to win a gold medal in Paris, because there's a quote I live by, and it's in my, literally in our high school yearbooks, you have to pick a quote that goes under your picture, and it's in my yearbook. And it says, and it's a Coco Chanel quote, and it says, to be irreplaceable, one must always be different. And for me, that quote, when I came across her journey, because she was also an orphan, there's so many connections. Wow. I was like, when I read that quote, it made me realize, wait a minute, society right now is telling me my differences are ugly and they're bad, but different also means irreplaceable. It means I'm irreplaceable as well. We are all of our differences, our skin color, our language, our voices, our hair, our bodies, each of us are so irreplaceable in this world. And that helped me process all that. So long story short, I love, 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 love handbags. I have an obsession. It's really, really not healthy at all. But one thing, one I don't have yet And I feel the only way to have it is the Coco Chanel bag. And I'm going to get it in France, in Paris, if I'm in the middle of that podium, if I'm on top of that podium, or if I just put medal in general in Paris and buy my first Coco Chanel bag in France. And I'm really, really excited about that because you cannot buy your first bag in France.
Sure. And that Chanel bag, you're not going to buy a knockoff in New York City. You're buying the real deal, right?
No.
Whatever the price.
Whatever the price. Well, also because, you know, well, I won't say whatever the price. I will be smart because also as a Paralympic athlete, we do not have the support, financial support Amen. As Olympic athletes at all. So I'll be very, I'll have to be smart with what, but it's, yeah, it's like, for me, you know, in Rio, I failed to get on the podium. The world's expectation in cycling was put on me based on my previous events and what I've done in the past. And honestly, that's probably the most frustrating thing for me is when people compare me to what I've done and what I've been able to overcome and still have somehow been able to have success through it all. It's hard. And that's probably the hardest thing leading into Paris. Is living up to people's expectations of the things that I went through because I some of my teammates and everyone said, well, you didn't make it on the podium in Rio, like you're done, because they just see me as that athlete that jumps from sport to sport.
Right.
And I believe in finishing what I start. And then just because I got fourth and the fifth place, I'm not going to stop there. I'm not going to quit. Mm-hmm. That's just step one. I didn't get it there. I'm used to not. I'm used to fourth and fifth place. I'm used to not getting this. In Tokyo, 100 days out from the games, they found a tumor in my leg that was causing me to get, I had gone to car accidents, bike crashes,
wow.
And it became a point where I had to make a choice. Did I want to continue having more, do I want to continue being an athlete in the future, or do I risk my health and my life and go to Tokyo without getting this surgery? So I chose my life first. I wanted to make sure, like, I'm an athlete now. I want to be an athlete for much longer. So 100 days on, the 100 days out, I ended up having a surgery to remove that and a bone graft done on my femur at the top. And I wasn't able to sit. I was out from training and everything. I wasn't allowed to sweat or do anything. Wear my prosthetics for 11 weeks.
Wow.
And then in Tokyo, I had an incredible coach, Ralph, and he got me ready with 2 months.
Wow.
And through that, I somehow got 2 gold medals. And I have no idea to this day how that happened. But that's what's hard, is living to the expectations of being at the bottom, coming out better than anyone expected. And in Paris, that's why all this pressure is put on. I'm trying not to put that on myself as well,
right,
and live up to it. But that extra, and the field's growing, sport's growing, which is so exciting.
Right.
But you know, the little Chanel bag is going to help get that little motivation on that 5-hour ride. Why are you still out here?
Right. Well, all the athletes who create expectations because they're, you know, incredibly talented, I always say, you know, it's your own fault.
You know, I guess we're lucky. I'm privileged and lucky to have that, to be the place where I put this expectation on myself. And I think I need to start viewing and seeing as, you know, people believe in me. And I think I don't believe in myself and the start line. I doubt myself. I'm the biggest critic and I'm my biggest doubter.
Wow.
But what I believe in is the belief in me from other people. And I just need to learn. It's about fine line, using that to help you believe in yourself, but then also, yeah, like not put in, you're not doing it for them. To prove them wrong, to prove them right,
right
in any way.
Just a few more as we wind down here. And these are some of the most profound things in a whole bunch of areas. You said you want to meet your birth family, your mom and dad. You used to hate them so much, but you've processed all of it over the years, and now you understand. I mean, that's quite a statement of that. That's some incredible growth to have that little kid, you know, what's going on? Where'd you go? And then you've worked through it.
Yeah, I think, you know, and sport helped me work through that. Sport helped me realize that through my body, helped me process through all the scenarios of why. My mom was a huge supporter she's always supported my birth family, was always on my birth mom's side, that, you know, they probably just didn't have, they were young when they had me, they didn't have the resources to care for me, and they didn't know they were putting you in this. And I think as a child, I blame them because I thought they knew what they're putting me in, why they chose, actually chose to give me away. And that is, I think, what hurt me the most and the anger I had the most. And, you know, that's through a child's lens and perspective. And when you're an adult, you start to see all the different things going on in the world, all the circumstances that are going on. And through sport, processing everything, it helps me realize that I guarantee you, they had no idea what I went through. And my mom said she wants to meet them too, to say thank you for having the courage to give me away, knowing they couldn't give me what I needed. No one can predict anything. Just because there's a few bad eggs in this world doesn't mean everyone has the worst intentions for you to live.
No doubt. Forgiveness is a powerful choice, for sure. You also say, I was lucky because what happened to me then is what led to the life I have now. There would be people who would read your story, and I get it, but that's not luck. But the fact that you've turned it all around is an incredible testament to your own inner strength and faith.
Thank you. I think it's like, you know, it's actually like you said, like you're choosing, the power of choice to choose forgiveness versus resentment. And it's the same thing. I'm robbing myself, and I'm robbing all these opportunities that I've been given in life. And I think for me, my fiance always is like, one of the things he loves about me is I'm like a child. I just get so excited when I see an ice cream cone and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so, and he just, that's a childlike, because I appreciate all the small things in life, not just the big shiny, oh my gosh, the gold medal, all these big things. And it's because I know what it's like to have nothing. And I knew that life first. And if I chose to resent life and hate the things in front of me now, all the doors would be closed. I would not have one single door that would open in front of me that I've had and had so much, been so fortunate for. And that's because I think it's a mindset. We can actively choose, do we want to live off, closed off and angry and mad at the world? Or do we want to accept, process on your timeline, and then continue to live the life that I'm so lucky, because I saw firsthand my best friend didn't make it. So I saw a lot of things, and I am very, very fortunate and lucky. And earlier, like I said, my sports journey parallels to my early childhood beginnings. And how would I know how to not race with a broken elbow, or to still choose to line up on the start line after removing a tumor, or picking myself up after getting fourth place and everyone told you didn't want it bad enough, that's why you didn't get on the podium, and all these things. We don't know the whys of life and what we're going through in the moment, but when we get back later on and sit back and reflect, it's funny how it does have a way of falling into its place and can match up if you will allow yourself to have a perspective to look at it through that lens.
Absolutely. So you mentioned your fiance, Eric, congratulations. I know you want your own family. And you said who wouldn't hear your story and think you'd be a great mom?
Oh, I hope so. My mom adopted me as a single parent, and she never necessarily felt the calling to be married, but she always felt the calling to be a mom. And I have the same calling in me. I want to be a mom so bad. And I think partially because I want to give my child, first of all, it's like the best. Yeah, I want to give my child something that I never had and experience that. And in some ways, like, I would be experiencing that for the first time myself and seeing all those, like, I'm just so fascinated by that. I love the adoption. I think it's so powerful. And I want to obviously have a child naturally, but then also want to adopt as well, because, I see the power of adoption, what I can do and save so many lives. And I don't know if I'm as strong as my mom. I don't know if I can adopt an older child. And that might be very selfish of me to say, because it's that fear. My mom wanted to adopt a baby because she didn't want to have a child go to her biggest fear of these things I did go through. And their life experience already, the first 7 years already formed, which is so crucial growing up. But adoption is huge for me, and I want to be a mom. And Aaron, I hope it'll be a good mom. I think I'm going to be that mom. where I'm going to be like, discipline. No, time out. Aaron is going to be that father.
You already have it scripted,
like,
okay, huh? You're going to be the tough one.
Wait till your mom gets home instead of what you're
doing. We'll see what happens. When you have that child, you'll see. It may all
but
flip around.
But he's such a lover.
It's one of the incredible things about parenting.
Yeah.
So last question. What was your biggest hope when you wrote the book?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many biggest hopes I had for this book.
Yep.
Because my story can touch on so many different aspects for people. But it's more for people to see whatever the hard things that they've went through in their lives, that is not their forever at all. And there's so much strength we can gain from the hardest moments of our life, to have that courage to triumph over all of that stuff and be even better than who we are. You know what I did not expect was I had so many parents who adopted reach out and said, thank you so much for sharing your story, because now I know how to be a better parent. All this stuff about my child makes so much more sense. I did not know. I thought it was helping a little girl or a boy on seeing the power of sports, on your biggest wounds and trauma and the hard days that you feel like in that moment you can't get through and there's no way out and people are always going to see you as what's been done to you. You have the choice to rewrite your own story and to write that next chapter and to write on to determine how your story will end, not based on how it started, but it's how it's ending. It's in your control. And I didn't know an overwhelming amount of kids from orphanages, Eastern European orphanages, a lot of them from Ukraine, but a lot of them from around the world.
Wow.
Literally saying that I went through this. I know exactly when you shared this. I know exactly this happened to me too. My parents don't know. I don't know how to say it. But for them, seeing someone like me who has a voice and it's heard and seeing that I'm successful and sharing what I went through and here in America, but then in Ukraine, I didn't realize how that for them, seeing it helped them realize they can chase their dreams and live their dreams. It's not just going to be this memory stuck and reliving this memory over and over and over. And I just, it hurt me to know that it's still happening. These are some young kids that I know that they were, it must be that they're still happening in orphanages and a lot of single, I think the power of adoption, the power of single parent and raising a child as a single parent and the Paralympic movement and sports and the power of sport that plays in all of us when we have access to it. And when we have that one person, that one coach that believes in us and makes and creates opportunities and gives us opportunities to try and succeed. And hopefully that's what people realize when they read the story. It's not about, wow, Oksana went through this. And then when they see me, they see that. I wrote in a way where, and shared it in a way and shared deep parts of me, because everyone thinks that an athlete at the top has this perfect right. story. There's no setbacks, that they come from this smooth sailing. And it happened overnight. And that is something that in the media is
right.
never covered. It's always the at their top of the mountain moments that are covered, not where they started. And that needs to start being shared, because that is what people, that's what bonds us together. And people can relate to that. So I haven't started on it, but when people read the book, they'll see I've had a lot of people say, well, what happened to your elbow? Because the story goes from my first experiences from the orphanage to that moment where I finally achieved my first Paralympic medal. And they'll read the story. I'm not going to tell now, but I was expected to win all these gold medals. And eventually, obviously in 2018, I was having a breakout season for myself. And two weeks before leaving, I break my elbow right before leaving for the Paralympic Games. And so my journey, the first book goes to that moment of when I won my first gold medal. What it doesn't cover is the second gold medal that I won that next day and more.
Wow.
And there's so much that has happened before, since then and now. And partially people say, well, like it's and the story doesn't make sense. It was just ends up right here and abruptly. And, you know, the whole thing isn't about the gold medal. It's not necessarily about sports. It's not a sports biography. Right. It's something so much greater than that.
Right.
And it was when you have that courage to like, when to triumph over everything, like that moment will happen. And it's a story of not having that timeline and all these things that happen and the active choices that we can make. Anyways, that's long story short. Short story I'm making longer now.
It's okay.
Yeah, like I definitely want to build upon my journey because it in a new in another book. And I was thinking about Aaron makes fun of me because he's like, is it going to be like a trilogy where it's going to be the hard parts, the hardest parts, and then the easy part kind of thing? Because my journey has so many. It's a tough journey to read, but then, you know, the easy part, I think, like, yeah, well, so we'll see. I definitely have more vision to share parts of my journeys. That's not me writing books and my stories isn't about just sports memoir at all. It's, you know, it's sharing a journey and a story that's never highlighted and covered. And to connect and help greater, like to help people and to make change.
Yep.
And my biggest dream is a kid's book I have.
I was about to say, there's a parenting book coming somewhere.
Yeah. And this, so this is going to be, this is a dream I've had for, oh my gosh, such a long time. And I don't want to get specifics, but I love animals. So it's going to be animal. But yeah, for like little kids.
That's awesome. Oksana Masters' profound and inspiring book is called The Hard Parts, a memoir of courage and triumph. It is all of that and so much more, as you can tell. Oksana, thanks so much for joining us on this Olympics.com podcast. Good luck in Paris, and we wish you well in all your future endeavors. This has been a really important and fun time for me. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for allowing me to share parts of my story and my journey to Paris.
Keep pushing.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
This is the Olympics.com podcast.
We are deeply grateful to Oksana for sharing her courageous story, one that's no doubt inspired many people around the world. So much more on Oksana right here for you in the form of original feature content across our platform here at Olympics.com. Original content from the start. Oksana Masters, my mom has been my biggest supporter. It's an incredible short feature. And also, content on Paralympic champion in wheelchair tennis and wheelchair basketball, Dylan Alcott. Well, that's it for this episode of the Olympics.com podcast. Thanks for being part of the Olympic community. Also, follow the Road to Paris 2024 Olympic qualifying process here as well. We'll see you next time.
For more in-depth and original Olympics-related feature content, search our platforms here on Olympics.com.